From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. David Ebershoff's new book, The 19th Wife, has become a bestseller. The novel tells two parallel stories about polygamy, and people seem to be fascinated by the subject these days. The story at a polygamous compound in Texas is still playing out. There's a popular HBO series where plural marriage is the critical plot point. Ebershoff's book is part murder mystery, part historical fiction, and he uses a lot of devices to weave his story together. There are fictionalized research papers and Wikipedia entries. He even wrote a Mormon hymn to be part of the story. Today in the program, he'll join us to talk about his book. It begins with the story of Anne Eliza Young. She was the actual wife of Mormon prophet Brigham Young. Aside from the suspense, the book is about devotion and the powerful mystery of faith. Please join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There are two threads running through David Ebershoff's popular new novel, The 19th Wife. One part is a mystery, a story told by Jordan Scott. He's a lost boy, exiled from a modern-day fundamentalist community on the Utah-Arizona border. Jordan's mother, one of the multiple wives of a leader in the community, has been accused of murdering her husband. The other part is the story told by Anne Eliza Young. It's Ebershoff's fictionalized version of a real person. Anne Eliza was one of the wives of Mormon leader Brigham Young. She creates a national scandal when she files for divorce in 1873 and left Mormonism to become one of polygamy's most vocal opponents. There are many connections in the two stories from two different time periods, but the most powerful may be the mystery of faith that draws women into such a lifestyle. David Ebershoff is the author of, among other books, Pasadena and the Danish Girl. The 19th Wife is actually his third novel. Ebershoff is also editor-at-large for Random House. He teaches in the graduate writing program at Columbia University. Today he's joining us by phone from his office at Columbia in New York City. And David Ebershoff, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
Doug, thanks very much for having me.
Well, let me begin, I guess, with the obvious, and that is, where did all of this begin? Did it in fact, start with Anne Eliza Young?
Yeah, for me, this book started with Anne Eliza Young. 7 years ago, I was speaking to a professor of 19th century women's history, a woman who knows a lot about that period and a lot about the lives of 19th century American women. And in this conversation I was having with her, the phrase, the 19th wife, popped up, and my ears stood up. I just thought, now that's a very unusual number in front of the word wife. Mm. And this colleague of mine told me briefly about Anne Eliza Young, told me how prominent she had been in the 1870s and 1880s. And as a writer, I was intrigued. And so I entered the story of the novel, The 19th Wife, through Anne Eliza Young. Mm. But as everyone knows, polygamy didn't end in 1890. There's a whole second act. And so that's why the book moves back and forth between the 19th century and today.
There's this question that Anne Eliza responds to in your version of the story, and in fact, it turns out in the actual book that she wrote, this: why did she submit to a polygamous lifestyle? Is this question she says she keeps getting time mm-hmm. after time, and her answer seems like one of the important themes that you considered in this book, that faith is what it's about, and faith is a mystery.
That's right. She says very early on, faith is a mystery, elusive to many, and never easy to explain. And this is one of the themes of the book. There are a lot of mysteries in the novel, The 19th Wife. There's the actual mystery that you introduced of Jordan Scott and his mother, who's been arrested for killing his father. But there are other... I play with the metaphor of mystery so that I can get to that question that you raise. Mm. The mysteries of faith, the mysteries of God, the mystery of God's will, these are things that are almost imponderable. It's impossible to stop thinking about them. There's no bottom to those questions. And I thought that using an actual mystery would be one way to illuminate those questions while sort of pointing to other mysteries in the story, so that these questions could go up in the reader's mind and let the reader ponder these and maybe reach his or her own conclusions.
I wonder, how is it that you that you came upon the unique structure that you have. I mean, there are all kinds of different elements in the story. You include fictionalized Wikipedia entries mm-hmm. and fictionalized research papers and mm-hmm. opinion pieces. How did you strike upon that form?
It came out of the material itself. Just as you say, the narrative of the book, especially the historical story, Anna Liza's story, has lots of different narrators. She narrates a portion of it, but her father, who ended up marrying five wives, narrates part of it. Her mother, who had to accept four other women into her household, narrates part of it. Her brother, who had two wives. Her son, who had nothing to do with polygamy, narrates portion of it. And even Brigham Young gets to narrate a portion of this story. And the reason I allow these different perspectives to speak is because it is a complicated issue. In the 19th century, in the 1870s, when Anna Liza Young was out speaking about polygamy in America, the American public, the American media was responding to it in a very similar way that we've been responding to polygamy in the United States in the last few years and certainly in the last many months. You can see a real echo in the news coverage and the American public's response. And that's because it's a very complex issue without any easy answers. In my mind, polygamy really points to a very fundamental American value, which is our belief in the right of religious freedom, our belief in others that have the right to believe what they believe. But polygamy presses on that right. It asks us, is there a limit to those rights? And if there are limits to those rights, who gets to decide what those limits are, and what are those limits? And so because of the complexity of the issue, I realized that the structure of the novel, The Nineteenth Wife, needed to reflect that complexity, and what seemed to me a good way of doing that was to allow different people with different perspectives on the issue to speak.
It's interesting how you kind of mix the real, like St. George, Utah, or Kanab, Utah, with the created Mesadale.
Right.
So you didn't want it to be completely divorced from real places, real place, I guess.
Right. This is a novel, and that's very important for everyone to keep in mind. This is a work of fiction, whether it's the contemporary story or the historical story. And I make that clear in an author's note at the back of the book. And so, of course, on the jacket, that this is a novel. That said, one of the reasons I sort of move in and out of fact and fiction is because this is a blurred story. I thought fiction is a really good way to handle these stories, whether we're talking about 19th century polygamy or 21st century polygamy, because a lot of times when we hear about it or we read about it, or we think about it, there are so many different points of view on these topics. And if you were to ask Anna Liza about her experiences as a plural wife, that would be different than Brigham Young's understanding of what his wives experienced. And so fiction seemed like a good way to accommodate these differences in perspectives. And that's why Brigham gets to speak in the book. And it's why Anna Liza's mother accepted plural wives into her household. We get to understand understand her faith and understand this through her perspective. And so fiction kind of allows the writer and therefore the reader to move around in perspectives, and it seems like this subject really blurs lines between fact and fiction in terms of our really knowing what is what. Because if you ask five different people about it, you're going to get five different answers.
Yeah.
It seems to me. And so I thought, well, a novel that really moves around in perspective, in point of view, in narrative voice, may be able to let the reader ponder these differences of opinions.
Tell us, if you would, about Jordan Scott a little bit more. How is it that I'm interested, at what point in your creation of the character did he become a gay man?
Jordan Scott is 20 at the start of the book, and as you said, he's a lost boy. He was expelled from his community when he was 14. His mother actually was the one who left him and drove him out of the community and left him to defend it on his own. And at the beginning of the book, he's 20, and against all odds, he's made it. Hmm. He's doing okay. He's living in California. He has a job. He has an apartment. He has a dog. And he has a van. So he's really kind of defied the odds. But he bears a lot of anger at the beginning of the book. He's very angry about what he experienced. And he hasn't processed it, and he hasn't come to, most important, he hasn't come to terms with it. And as you say, he is a gay man. And I thought one of the reasons why that would be an interesting perspective is later in the book, he meets another gay man, a man named Tom, who's about 25 years old. And Tom is grew up in a Latter-day Saint family, very faithful, really loves his church. This is present day. And he's gay, and he has had to leave his church because of that. But Tom's response to that rejection is not to reject his own faith. He actually continues to maintain his faith, although he is not allowed to participate in certain rites and go into the temple, for example. He still believes. And I wanted Jordan to encounter somebody whose faith can maintain his faith in spite of being told he shouldn't be able to do that. And I wanted Jordan to see a different kind of faith and a different kind of response to these questions of faith. And so in meeting Tom and also in coming to terms with his own mother, Jordan begins to accept himself in many, many ways and accept his past. And so by he being a young gay man, it seemed like this is a good way to illuminate some of these questions.
You know, Tom is an intriguing character, I have to say. I mean, he, as you say, he's still clinging to aspects of his faith.
Mm-hmm.
He still wears his Mormon temple garments, mm-hmm. There's this kind of profound sense of integrity in Tom. And while in Jordan you find this kind of anger and pessimism, Tom is he's a deeply optimistic character.
Right. I think that this is what I was trying to represent with this character, Tom, and therefore so that Jordan's point of view could change over the course of the novel, so that he's a different person at the end of the novel, which is what, as readers, we want to see, we want to experience, was with Tom to show how personal faith can be, and so that it really... one of those mysteries of faith is about what lies in the individual heart. And what lies in the individual heart is perhaps a very true definition of faith. And so Tom manages to hold on to his faith and revere his faith in a very individual manner. And this makes sense to Jordan because he needs to come to terms with his own mother, who maintains her faith despite what's happened to both of them.
Mm.
And so Tom is an example of somebody who we might think shouldn't be able to remain faithful, but is. And I wanted to reveal a different kind of faith to the reader. At the same time, in Jordan's story, he meets other Mormons who are helping him through his story, help him solve the mystery. People who... are very, very helpful in him not only solving what really happened between his mother and his father, but also coming to terms with who he is and what he's been through.
You know, in the acknowledgement section of your book, you quote this historian who says that Mormon and anti-Mormon literature is frequently unreliable. And I guess it's important to point out, David Ebershoff, this is not an anti-Mormon book, not remotely, but it seems like you're having to make that point from time to time.
Well, people do ask that. I think if you pull out one line here or there, you might misrepresent what the book is doing.
Yeah.
But because it's a novel and because I really trust the intelligence of readers, I think that the whole book will show why it's not anti-Mormon, because we have so many different perspectives on 19th century LDS history as well as 21st century a fundamentalist community, as well as people who are Mormons today who are responding to that fundamentalist community and trying to help Jordan and help other people. So you get a lot of different perspectives. I received an email a couple days ago from a Mormon who was very excited about the book. And what he said to me was, we revere Brigham Young. And it was so interesting to him to see Brigham Young rendered as a human being, which of course he was. And to me, this response is something how I also think of somebody in American history of somebody like Thomas Jefferson. We revere Thomas Jefferson for the ideals that he established in American culture and American life, but he has a complicated legacy because of the issue of slavery. It doesn't mean we stop, we don't revere him, but it just it makes us understand him in a more complex manner. And so in writing Brigham Young into the novel, which he inevitably has to be, but also allowing him to speak, I simply wanted to render him as a full and complex human being. And so this email I got a couple days ago, this man was telling me that this is what he responded to most, was thinking about Brigham in this complex manner, and in some ways made him even closer to Brigham.
David Ebershoff is with us. His latest book is called The 19th Wife. We're going to take a brief break. Back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the writer David Ebershoff is with us talking about his new book, the popular and best-selling The 19th Wife. It's a novel, but also part murder mystery, part historical fiction. As you can probably guess by the title, the book is a portrait of polygamy, an historical account, but also a modern-day view. The book is built around the story of Anne Eliza Young, one of Brigham Young's actual wives, who creates a scandal when she files for divorce in 1873 and leaves Mormonism to become one of polygamy's most vocal opponents. I wanted to ask you, David Ebershoff, about the city of Mesa Dale.
Mm-hmm.
It's this fictional enclave in a modern-day polygamist community, styled after, I guess it's pretty obvious, Colorado City and Healdale on the Utah-Arizona border. Did you have to go there to get a sense of the place?
Yes, I went there a number of times, and as many of your listeners probably know, its remoteness is one of its unique features. You have to drive pretty far to get there. I like to think of it as it's on the way to nowhere, and its location is very important in its identity. I needed to get a sense of that, to sense of that remoteness, and of course a sense of just the physical details as a place to start in order to begin to recreate a town that has some similarities to it.
You know,
the town is called Mesa Dale in the book, and it is a fictional town. It's not Colorado City, but it certainly is inspired by.
You know, it's one of the intriguing parts of the book, both Anne Eliza's story and Jordan's story, is that you take us into that environment, that lifestyle. And I want to have you read this section. This is Jordan, who is trying to help his mother, trying to exonerate her from this crime. And he actually drives back in for the first time in years, of course.
Mm-hmm.
To Mesa Dale. Talk about this section, if you would, and read this for us.
Sure. This is toward the beginning of the book. He's been away from Mesa Dale for 6 years. He never thought he would go back. He never thought he would see his mother or his father or his family again. And as you say, he wants to exonerate his mother, who's been arrested for killing his father. And so he has to go back into that world. And in doing so, not only does he need to solve the crime, he really needs to come to understand the world he came from, understand his mother, whom he does love, even after everything that they've been through, and understand himself. And so this scene, he's just coming back into Mesa Dale. It's early in the morning. It's in summertime. And I'll just start. And this is in Jordan's voice. He's telling his own story.
Right.
He's 20 years old. Over in the foothills, I could see Mesa Dale waking up to the dawn. From here, it was a cluster of white and yellow lights beneath the mountain. I knew exactly what was going on at each of those lights. I knew it the way you know a DVD you've watched 100 times. A sister wife was flicking on a lamp to brush out her hair. Another was striking a match to light the stove. A third wife was pulling the string on the pantry bulb, hauling out a large box of corn mush. 10, 15, 20 more lights in a house. Each was a sister wife rising to perform her chores. And the kids. About now, the kids would be climbing out of bed, rubbing the sand from their eyes. They'd be forming a line at the sink to wash. The boys would be searching the boxes for a shirt. The girls would be helping one another pin up their hair. You don't talk much at that hour. You just dress fast so you can get to the kitchen in time for your plop of mush. Sometimes there was toast and canned peaches, but not always. Whatever there was never enough. Only a fool would waste time taking a leak before getting something to eat. As I drove closer, I could see Mesadale had grown. There were a few hundred houses now, warehouses for families of 75. No one knows how many people live out there, but I'm going to guess 12,000, maybe 15. Counting is complicated. The numbers are part of the mystery. The less you know, the less you know.
David Ibershoff reading from his book, The 19th Wife. David Ibershoff, you had this experience when you were in that area,
mm-hmm.
Which Jordan has this experience, which I'm guessing you drew it from your own experience of being followed by a police officer in the area.
Yeah, that's right. I the first time I went down to Hilldale, Colorado City, I drove into town and I went to the supermarket there. It's a fairly public place, just to get a sense of where I was and what I might be writing about. This was before I really had a sense of what the story would be, what the novel, The 19th Wife, would become. And I was in the supermarket, and the people in there, they were mostly sister wives shopping together, three or four together at a time, some with their children, and they politely ignored me. It was clear I wasn't from there, and they just politely ignored me. But there was one small child, a boy maybe 7 or 8 years old, who wouldn't stop looking at me, and it was evident that he knew I was from someplace else, and he was very curious. In his eyes, I could see it. He was very curious about the someplace else I was from. And I was a little haunted by the way he was looking at me, a little uncertain of what I could or should do, which was really nothing. So I got in my car, left the supermarket, and I was thinking about that young boy's eyes. And they were sort of floating before my eyes as I started driving around the community, up and down the streets, looking at the large houses, trying to take it in and get a sense of where I was. And I lost a little bit a sense of what I was doing, kind of dazed and thinking about that little boy. And I looked up in my rearview mirror, and I saw a police cruiser following me. And I wondered if he was really following me. And I turned, and then he turned, and I turned, and he turned. And again, I turned, and he turned. And it was clear he was following me. And it was clear that he didn't want me in town. And so I realized, I thought, well, perhaps for this first visit, enough has happened, enough to sort of start me on my way. And I drove out of town back to the county highway, and he followed me down and made sure I got on that highway and drove off. And that happens to Jordan. There's a scene pretty similar to that in the book. And I think that what I wanted to show was, you know, Jordan, at the start of this book, he's an outsider in many, many ways, just as I was. And yet he has to go back inside the community in order to figure out what's really happened. And so at the beginning of the book, this experience happens to him. And in some ways, you know, I was an outsider to this. And that idea of outsiderness is also part of the book, what it means to be from a community and be an outsider to that community, or what does it mean to leave that community or to become an outsider. Anna Liza becomes an outsider. You know, her parents were early converts to the church. They were very faithful. She was raised in a very faithful household. So for her to leave when she left Brigham Young in 1873, it meant leaving everything she knew, her family, her faith, her church, and leaving Utah, and she became an outsider. So this idea of being an outsider is also part of what the book is thinking about.
Let's take a call from Paul. Paul's in South Jordan, Utah. Paul, welcome.
Thanks. Great show.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I have a quick question. Years ago when I lived in Michigan, this sort of relates to what you just started talking about. A friend found Anne Eliza Young's original expose that she wrote. She found the book in a garage sale and gave it to me.
Yep.
And I read it. It was a fun read, you know, how they wrote back then, it's sort of this polemical way. And I tried to find out whatever happened to her, because I know she left Utah and went on a circuit to promote her book and to sort of expose Mormonism and so on and so forth. But when I was looking, of course this was before Google, I couldn't really ever find out what eventually happened to her. Does anybody know? Were you able to find out?
Let me, there are a couple of things I want to respond to. Thanks for your call.
Yeah.
First, she did write a book called Wife Number 19, and it was a very important part of her crusade to end polygamy in the United States. It exposed Americans to her experiences as a plural wife. And then she wrote a second book in 1908, a second memoir. And that first memoir was a big bestseller, well known at the time and somewhat well known today. In fact, if you go to my website, which is 19thwife.com, you can download a copy of that book. It was a very important book in my research, and readers can go read the original by going to the website. Her second book proves her to be a little more thoughtful. Enough time has passed between her experiences as a plural wife, and so in the second book, she is a little more thoughtful and has a little more perspective on her understanding of these issues. And that second book is a very rare book, hard to find, and was read by very, very few people at the time in 1908. The reason I mention that second book is because after that, we have no firm record of what happened to her. There's no definitive document or picture or anything else to tell us her whereabouts after that second book came out in 1908. And ultimately, her fate is unknown, and her fate is a mystery. And that's one of the many mysteries in The 19th Wife, is pondering the mystery of Anne Eliza Young. Her son narrates part of the book, and when he's narrating the book, a lot of time has passed. It's now in 1940, the early 1940s, and he's really thinking back long ago to these events, and he is pondering the mysterious, unknown fate of his own mother. And so the reader gets to think about that mystery as well. To answer your question, as far as I know, we don't know ultimately what happened. There are theories. There are conspiracy theories. There is some flimsy evidence of sightings of her as late as the 1920s, but nothing definitive. And I've often wondered with the publication of The 19th Wife if something definitive would come up, if someone somewhere knew something or had a letter or knew of a gravestone somewhere that would tell us where she was when she died, and when that was, but we just don't know, which is remarkable given how prominent she once had been.
You know, Paul says, he refers to the writing in the book that he read, the way they, as he said, the way they wrote back then. And I have to say, it sounds like for a writer, this must have been a challenge to take on the writing style of a number of different people. I mean, you write this introductory essay by Harriet Beecher Stowe. There's a diary entry by Brigham Young. Was that hard? And did you have to sort of get into character to write like that?
It was. I mean, it took some thinking, but ultimately I just thought about the kind of story I wanted to tell, the kind of book I would want to read, and as you say, there's a faux preface by Harriet Beecher Stowe to the faux memoir by Anne Eliza Young, and I thought that my readers would understand why there are all these pieces and all these different voices, because that's what it's like to go into the archives on this subject. That's what it's like to Google the subject is to find all these different people speaking out about it. And for me as a writer, I sort of thought of it in part as a very interesting challenge to take on some well-known people like Harriet Beecher Stowe, like Brigham Young, and to channel their voices and articulate their points of view. But it seemed like that was part of what I wanted to accomplish with the book. So it was hard in the sense that it required some reading, you know, a lot of reading, and in many senses, to get a sense of the voice, the language, the preoccupations. But somebody like Brigham left us a lot of his words through his sermons, through his letters, diaries. So there's a lot to read so that I could pick up cadences. And then ultimately, for example, with Brigham, he's writing a diary that, in the novel, he's writing a diary about the one night he spent in prison over his divorce from Annalisa Young, which he did. And I thought, well, this is a chance to ponder what Brigham would have thought to himself, what he would have thought when he was alone with himself. I really wanted to know that. That was something I, as a reader, would want to know. And yet, that, by its very definition, cannot exist. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, let me try to create it and then leave it to the reader. I leave it to the reader to decide, you know, how they accept it or don't accept it. But I wanted to. So I was sort of giving myself the challenge and then give the reader a second challenge to respond to it.
Well, I have to say, I'm intrigued by the fact that you even channel Mormon founder Joseph Smith. You even imagine how he spoke with this, as you describe it, this high whistling sound. It's, mm-hmm. it's kind of a an intriguing part of the book. There's this interview, in fact, also with Joseph Smith by this supposed Howard Greeley of the New York Herald, which is, I guess, an allusion to the Brigham Young interview by Horace Greeley.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, there are things that we know about these people, and we know that there are witnesses who said that Joseph Smith had a high whistling sound to his voice when he spoke. So once you find a historical tidbit like that, you can then use it not just to sort of ground the story in historical fact, but also to then kind of take that and imagine from it. And there is a scene where Joseph is explaining his faith to a group of people, one of those people being Annalisa Young's
mother.
And I had to think, well, what would convince a young woman to believe in this man and believe in his vision of faith and his church? This was in the early 1830s, at very early days of the Mormon church. So what would convince people to believe him when he was a stranger? And of course, he did convince people. And so I had to imagine the quality of his speaking in addition to what he was telling people. And he was obviously very forceful, powerful speaker who spoke of things that went straight to people's hearts.
David Ebershoff is with us. His latest book is called The 19th Wife. We're going to take another break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us the writer David Ebershoff talking about his latest novel, The 19th Wife. Let's go back to the phones. Melanie is with us, calling from Orem, Utah. Melanie, hi.
Hi, Doug. I have a comment. I'm pretty... Polygamy kind of... It really interests me because my family, going back to our early... we're one of the early members in the church, and, you know... The Pulsifers, they were a huge polygamous family. Anyway, my comment was one day, we used to live in Hurricane, and we'd see a lot of polygamists. And I was at the doctor's office one day, and my son, he was about 3 or 4, and there was a couple there, and they had they had two children, and my son kept trying to play with them. And the father was very annoyed that my son was trying to, you know, just playfully, you know, how children are. And anyway, after a couple minutes, he was so annoyed with my son trying to play with his kids that he made them go out in the hallway and sit by themselves. I felt really bad because, you know, how do you explain to a three-year-old, you know, they just can't, you know, play with these kids because their parents aren't, you know, just don't want them to.
This idea of isolation, that's an important part of that community, of that life, I guess. David Ebershaw?
Yeah, I would say that's what I would think was going on is that for a long time, ever since the late 19th century, American polygamists have had to isolate themselves in order to practice what is a religious belief. And so there is a certain amount of paranoia about mingling with people outside their faith, and it is part of their faith not to talk to non-believers. And so you can understand, one way to understand it is to think of them sort of as self-protection, just trying not to reveal themselves too much so that they can continue with their way of life and their personal beliefs. And yet it's very difficult in the modern day not to interact with the larger world, and especially in the last many years with technology and the internet, it is especially difficult to remain isolated. And so I think that's been one of the reasons why there's been a lot of disruption among American polygamists in this community in particular in the last decade or so. It's just the outside world has been coming in different forms, and their members have had much more interaction with the outside world.
We're glad you called. Thanks very much. David Ebershoff, tell me about Kelly D. She's the name of a woman you give to this researcher who's doing research, and she starts to take on, at first it just seems like she's a scholar, but she starts to take on kind of, I don't know if it's an important role, but certainly she takes on this character as part of the book.
Yeah, Kelly D is a character in the book. She's a young graduate student at Brigham Young University studying women's history. And she starts off writing a senior thesis paper about Anna Liza's mother, and whom she calls the first wife. And that paper is part of the book, part of The 19th Wife. And so the reader meets Kelly D through her senior thesis research paper. This is, of course, fiction, but that's how the reader meets her. And as the book unfolds, she does become a very important character because she's one of the reasons these different documents that we've been talking about arise and come together. She's one of the reasons that this narrative is being told this way. And she connects with Jordan because she goes on to graduate school, and she's very interested in knowing more about Anna Liza Young, and this is set present day. And so she's researching Anna Liza Young, and she connects with Jordan because she works at a fictional place called the Anna Liza Young House, which does not exist, but it imagines such a place. And this is a place that helps women and children transition from polygamous families, polygamous communities, into the larger world, and to a place to go in their first step of leaving a polygamous community or a polygamous family. And Anna Liza connects with Jordan through this house. Kelly D connects to Jordan through this house. And then you begin to realize that actually her role is even bigger. She's one of the primary reasons that all of these stories are being told and they've been assembled this way.
Kelly describes the subject of polygamy as an unfinished topic of inquiry for scholars and writers within Mormonism. How do you talk about, I guess, what sort of conclusion did you come to about that relationship between modern-day Mormonism now and the subject of polygamy, because there is a connection, even though some, the Mormon Church is quick to point out that they stopped practicing polygamy in 1890, but there still is a connection there that you refer to. What sort of conclusions have you come to about that relationship?
Well, I'd say probably I won't use the word conclusion because I want to leave a lot of room for the reader to interpret. But Kelly D is pressing on these questions as a graduate student, as a Mormon. As a graduate student, she's pressing on these questions through her research, which is part of the narrative of the book. And she's thinking hard about the relationship of Mormon the relationship of polygamy in Mormon history. And she wants to resolve some questions that she does not have resolved in her own mind. I would say that in my experience of researching the book and talking to people, on the subject of polygamy in 19th century Mormon history, I heard a lot of different perspectives, and many of those perspectives did not reconcile in terms of how many polygamists were there, how frequent was it, how much was it promoted. I heard a lot of different answers to questions like that, And I say this not with any criticism, but just as observation, that because these questions have not been answered, there's room left to ponder this question, the larger question of polygamy in 19th century Mormon history. As you say, after 1890, the church has been very clear about its position. But before that, it was a important part of Mormon culture, and that the leaders of the Mormon Church were, for the most part, polygamous in the 19th century. And so Kelly D, as a 21st century Mormon, as a young woman who loves her church and her faith, but is also a rigorous scholar, and she's a rigorous historian, she wants to look at this question openly, and she believes that that her understanding of her faith and her religion gives her a unique perspective to ask these questions and probe a little more deeply without ever undermining her faith. And in fact, her faith is never undermined by looking into the past. In fact, actually, her faith expands by looking to the past.
Hmm. Let me read a few emails which get to an interesting question, that is the references that were the most helpful for you.
Yeah.
Nancy writes this. In the 1960s, Irving Wallace wrote a nonfiction account of Eliza Young. It was titled The 27th Wife.
Right.
How much did that author depend on? How much did you, I guess, depend on that earlier account? And others have asked. Debbie from Las Vegas just called wanting to know about the relationship there. And what were the other sources that you use, Patricia asks also, to help you sort of fill in the story?
Sure. The 27th Wife is a biography from the early 1960s. That I certainly look to many times. It's very reliable, and it sets the story in a lot of context. Just as important were Wallace's archives. He left his archives to Claremont McKenna in Southern California, and left those open to the public. And so all of his research that he pulled for The 27th Wife is available and open to the public. And so I got to go through his archives and look at documents that he had pulled but that are not used especially, or that he makes brief reference to in that book, and as well as some interviews that he conducted. I got to read the full transcripts and certain things. So even more so than the book itself was the research that he put together to write the book, which I'm very grateful to him and to his heirs for leaving that research open and accessible to the public. So that was an important part of it. As I mentioned earlier, Ann Eliza's two memoirs were an important part of it. But there's also a lot else out there. Ann Eliza, as we've talked about, was a very well-known figure in the 1870s. She went on a lecture tour that lasted almost 10 years. She spoke in large and small towns across America, and everywhere she went, the local newspaper, or I should say almost everywhere she went, the local newspaper covered her story and reported on her. And so there's a long trail of newspaper articles about her. In addition to this, the Utah Press at the time really covered the story, covered it very closely, of Anna Liza's divorce from Brigham Young. So there's a large record of newspaper accounts about the story and about the divorce. The court papers exist, and so everybody's the legal filings are all available to look at. In addition to this, Anna Liza went to Congress, testified before Congress, spoke to President Grant, and the people who listened to her left accounts of their day with Anna Liza Young at the Capitol in Washington. And so through different kinds of sources, I could piece together her story. But then there was a lot of background reading as well, biographies of Brigham, letters to his sons, his sermons. There's one of the great things about this very topic, about 19th century LDS history, is it's just vast, and the church has done a wonderful job preserving its history, making a lot of it accessible. A lot of it is online. A lot of museums that are open and free to the public, well-staffed, and so there's a lot of places to go as well, in Salt Lake City, of course, and in Nauvoo, where I spent some time as well.
Let's take a call from David, who's in San Pete, Utah. David, welcome.
Hey, thanks, guys. Sure. I listen to Radio West a lot.
Good.
Usually on the road. I just had a question. It's an interesting conversation, what he's providing, a lot of history and whatnot, but I'm wondering if they profiled the market of who would buy this book. And I'll take the answer off there.
Well, it raises a question, David Ebershoff. It's incredibly popular. What do you make of the book's success? What are people responding to? And I'm not sure what to make of the question of who's your market. Who is responding to it, I guess?
Well, I've been getting emails from a lot of different kinds of people. And so I can sort of speak to that. I've received a lot of emails from Mormons who've been very excited and interested in hearing this part of their history. When I've been on the road at the events that I've done, people have come up to me and said, I'm an LDS and I'm really happy that you wrote this book. Thank you very much. So I've been getting that kind of response. Same time, I'm just getting a sort of a wide response of people who are interested in American history. I mean, I think of this as this is an American story, that this is an American question, and so people who are interested in perhaps a unique look at American history, that maybe is who's coming to it. There are a lot of strong women in this book, and it's very difficult to sort of know market-oriented questions about books and who buys books and book publishing, but we do know that more women buy books than men, and this book has a lot of strong women, and I suppose that would appeal to some of these people, some of these women who buy books. But the range has been I would say it's a fairly broad range of people responding from, and I do know from the sales that we have, it's East Coast, West Coast, middle of the country. It seems to be sort of a national response.
We've got about a minute left. Let me ask you this finally. I think it's important to say, as you did before, that that you don't draw any conclusions at the end, that you're not trying to settle the matter. You're pleased with the idea that there is a conversation, that there is an ongoing debate about these questions.
That's right. The book itself has a dialogue within itself. In fact, for example, Anna Liza says something about her relationship to Brigham Young, and then maybe 40 pages later, when her son is narrating part of the story, he actually corrects her at some point and says, you know, she got that part wrong, or she may have overemphasized something. So that the book talks to itself through the characters' different voices, and that's because we talk to ourselves about this very issue, and that there's no one person who can settle the question of polygamy in America, both today and in history, And there's no one perspective that allows us to come to any conclusions. And I wanted the book, I wanted the reader to finish the book and start thinking rather than take my thinking. I wanted the reader to have a set of stories that enables him or her to ponder this very large question.
David Ebershoff, his latest book is called The 19th Wife. David Ebershoff, thanks very much for the time.
Thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program directed by Mike Anderson, produced by Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.